The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
So welcome, everybody. My name is Fernando LaGuarda. I'm the faculty director of the Program on Law and Government. And this is our continuing series on the presidential impeachment trial. Once again, we are delighted to have Professor Kim Wheely here with us, who is visiting from University of Baltimore and is a visiting fellow in law and government, teaches constitutional law and civil procedure here, and has been interviewed in the media and been doing a lot of writing on the impeachment. So we're delighted to have her back. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
So a lot has happened, and I think we're going to call this impeachment recap. It's our third in a series on the trial in the Senate, but sort of taking a look back, I do want to talk about what's taken place and then kind of make some predictions about the future based on what's happening now and the aftermath of impeachment. But can you take us back just to recap for those who might be joining at this point? The House manager's case, what was the case that they brought against the president, and what were the claims that were made?
So two articles of impeachment. I understand, I've heard from people that were inside the bunker in the House, that they actually started with 32 and narrowed it down to two. And the two were abuse of power, and the second was obstruction of Congress. So the abuse of power argument was that in withholding the $391 million of aid that the Senate had appropriated for Ukraine, in making that determination to withhold it and not let Congress know, even though the statute required that, the president abused his power because he did that not in the interest of the United States, not in the interest of foreign policy, not in the interest of Ukrainian democracy, but in order to get pressure the Ukrainians to announce an investigation into his then primary political rival for the 2020 presidency, Joe Biden. So it was for personal gain, not for the interests of Americans, and that office is really like a fiduciary. They didn't use that word, but I use that word. That he's not there because he is ordained somehow with inherent power, but because he has the power of the people and has to exercise it that way. That's essentially the House manager's argument on Article 1. On Article 2, obstruction of Congress, the argument was that there is essentially an obligation by the on various branches to cooperate or coordinate and respect each other's prerogatives. And in this instance, the White House didn't just do what other White Houses have done, that is, respond and then raise objections, like civil litigants do in discovery, for example. You produce documents and say, well, I'm going to redact these pieces because it's privilege, and they'll have a fight about privilege. Instead of doing that, the White House just said, we will not give you anything, and directed people within who had been in the administration or previously worked for the administration, directed them not to comply with subpoenas at all. So that was essentially a massive immunity argument. The idea, not so much that you can show up in Congress and assert legitimate privileges like executive privilege, but that you cannot show up at all. And the basis, I think, for the obstruction of Congress charge was that both Richard Nixon, or I said the underpinnings, legal underpinnings, both Richard Nixon and Bill Clinton went to the United States Supreme Court on a notion of blanket immunity for the United States president, and the court knocked them down. So as lawyers, we know if the president himself doesn't have such kind of absolute immunity, it was really a frivolous argument to say people that worked for the president have broader immunity from process than the president himself. So that was basically the argument. We can talk about the extent to which they did a good job and did not so good job. I think that they can be criticized for how that was set up. The president's defense was twofold. On number one, on abuse of power, it morphed. It started out as, well, the narrative is not what you think it is. The money wasn't withheld to entrench the president's power. The money was instead withheld because the president wanted the Ukrainians to investigate Joe Biden and the alleged Ukrainian interference in the 2016 election, and he really cares about sort of dislodging corruption in Ukraine. The problem with that was he fired a former Ukrainian ambassador, Marie Yovanovitch, unceremoniously, and she was really a champion of rooting out corruption in Ukraine. In addition, the wrongdoing that Joe Biden allegedly did was to try to get the former Ukrainian chief prosecutor fired. He was a very corrupt prosecutor. That was completely consistent. There's no ambiguity there. So Biden was actually working to root out corruption. So that narrative kind of fell apart. The second one that was floated was burden sharing, that there was that he did that because he wanted European countries to share the burden of defending, giving money to Ukraine. And Trump has given a lot of money to Ukraine, but there really wasn't any factual basis for that defense, and that sort of floated away. I think their primary defense was that, well, this happened, but it's not impeachable, that it's not a basis for removal because removal upends elections. And, oh, by the way, this is so political. And, oh, by the way, the Democrats screwed up in not getting all the facts out when they had the power, which I think is a legitimate critique. On obstruction of Congress, the argument was, well, all they wanted to do was litigate this, and they're entitled to litigate it, and the Democrats didn't bring these issues to the federal courts. The problem, that's assuming there was a good faith response to begin with, and we know even in civil litigation, if you completely ignore a request for production of documents in a civil context, you can be sanctioned. You do have to at least good faith respond, and I think the argument under the second article was the complete stonewalling was so unprecedented, it can't go unchecked. And one thing I don't understand why the Democrats didn't include in the second article was that it's actually a crime to obstruct Congress. So we heard a lot about how the impeachment articles didn't allege a crime, but they did. They just didn't articulate it that way and didn't argue it that way for whatever reason.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about that defense argument. I guess you're not calling it so much a defense as a theme maybe, or suggesting it's a theme about that there was no crime alleged somehow. That was sort of most succinctly put by Alan Dershowitz in his a summation, but also argued throughout the defense. Do you feel that that was a frivolous defense argument, or do you think that that actually had some it had some merit to it?
Well, my colleague at CBS News, my co-legal analyst Jonathan Turley, testified for the Republicans in the House impeachment proceeding, and even he, who's, quite, I think, hawkish in protecting the president's prerogative across the board here. Even he admits that abuse of power alone can be a basis for impeachment. I think Dershowitz was out on a limb there, which probably reflects in part that he's not a constitutional scholar. He's a criminal defense lawyer and a criminal law professor. But his position, and he got a lot of pushback, but I was frankly relieved when he said it on the Senate floor, because it really is the theory animating the defense here, is that, the president, they use the words, it's a policy decision. Okay, the president made a policy determination with respect to foreign aid. He has discretion over policy determinations. That you're trying to climb inside his brain and determine intent. Well, of course, all kinds of things, activity becomes criminal based on intent. Activity becomes civilly liable based on intent, discriminatory intent. So essentially, boiled down, the argument was, if the president is making judgments as president, that is unassailable, that is unaccountable. And Dershowitz, I'm paraphrasing, basically said, if the president makes a determination, and I think he conceded the facts were what they were, that it was important to withhold aid in order to get himself reelected, if he believes in his mind that reelection is best for the American people, that is cannot be impeachable. That his belief in what's best for the American people is what's best for we the people, and he has that level of discretion. Of course, that is it's hard to – the reason I think he got pushback is that is an articulation of the power of a monarch, potentially an autocrat. That's unlimited power, and of course, that's exactly what the framers and the revolutionaries fought and died to break away from in common law England and the sovereignty principles that they thought were oppressive. So that can't be the case. But these are sort of technical, somewhat theoretical, scholarly arguments that most people don't understand. And so when you frame it as all the president did was withhold some aid, he gets to withhold aid, that makes sense, I think, to a lot of people and, you know, that are supporters of the president, that the Senate majority Republicans had to think about in terms of their own reelection.
I want to ask about the argument about witnesses and about the deliberations, but I want to, since we're on this point and you've stated it so well about what arguments the defense made, skipping to the end, the president was acquitted. Do you draw conclusions about the acceptance of those arguments? Is there jurisprudence of impeachment? Is this purely political? Do we look and now say, well, there have been two modern trials and we can draw some line here in terms of principles? Or do you think this is very much limited to the application in the case before the Senate this time around?
You know, I'm actually, and I don't really come out normally and say this publicly, but I'm of the mind if this conduct was not impeachable, it's really hard to identify what would be impeachable other than treason.
This is public.
Treason.
You know. This is public.
Yeah, I mean, we're at this point where, thank you, treason. Right? Treason would, I would assume be impeachable, but that requires declaration of war, which we don't do anymore. So that's not really feasible. Bribery, I don't have an opinion on whether effectively Article 1 was bribery. There are a lot of scholars that believe it was framed as bribery, even if it wasn't articulated as bribery. It was more like extortion. You do this for me or else we won't, you know, or else I won't give you the aid. And of course, we know as a matter of notice pleading, the civil context, you don't have to cite the cause of action as long as there's notice of what the facts alleged are. So maybe bribery wouldn't qualify. High crimes and misdemeanors, there's a strong argument that if the crime doesn't relate to abuse of office, like for Bill Clinton, perjury in relating to his marital affairs, that's not impeachable. So if you read the president's briefs, the argument they articulated for the standard was a crime that is also undermines the sanctity of the Constitution. So I'm not sure what that needle threading is. That being said, actually had a talk today with the Federal Society and here at American University, Washington College of Law, and a student raised a great question, which is that given that impeachment's 51% and removal is a supermajority, is there ever a circumstance where politically impeachment and removal is feasible? I don't know. I mean, in this polarized context, probably not. So a 51% for both houses would probably be so low that maybe impeachment and removal would be used just to as political pushback if you had Congress that's not the same from the same party as the president. But as like a supermajority on both ends wouldn't work either. I don't think today, and we can talk about what's happened since impeachment with this president is not demonstrating, unlike I think what Lisa Murkowski anticipated, for example, Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski and her rationale for acquittal, this president is not in any way chastened. You know, his behavior isn't being cabined or limited or in any way shaped by the threat of impeachment anymore. And so, that's really the question. Is it a consequence that keeps people with massive power in check? And I don't know if that is the case anymore.
So, that's a good reformulation of my question, which I think is probably impossible to answer about whether or not you could create some kind of jurisprudence more practically. Does it have an impact? Let's put a pin on that and get back to, we've skipped forward about, you know, what does it all mean? Let's go back to the process here. There was a live question about whether senators should hear from witnesses. John Bolton was sort of the witness that most Democrats wanted to hear from. What happened to that process and the arguments that were made for and against witnesses?
Okay, so the problem, and I have said this since December, I think in part was that the House Democrats did not subpoena Mr. Bolton, and they didn't move to compel, and the argument was it was take too long. I think that was bad lawyering, frankly. It was not sufficiently aggressive. The courts can move quickly, and I think even if they can't, they should have proceeded with impeachment and taken the argument off the table that's legitimate as a strategic from a strategic standpoint, that the Democrats should have done more.
Senator Doug Jones from Alabama made that exact point and pointed out how in Bush v. Gore, the case got resolved by the Supreme Court in time for an inauguration, and so the courts are capable of getting stuff like this done.
Absolutely. I think that was a massive blunder.
Have you heard anything as to why or the inside thinking?
All I've heard is what we've heard publicly from Madam Schiff was this delay problem, but I think strategically it was a massive blunder. And I try, frankly, in my little voice, I did write a piece early December saying, hello, these are the reasons why you should subpoena and move to compel. But I don't have any inside track to the strategy there. And of course, they're excellent lawyers. But the stakes are so massively high. So then we got to the, and I should say, in the Democrats' defense, unlike for Bill Clinton, unlike for Richard Nixon, there was no prosecutor. We had Leon Jaworski, we had Ken Starr, no prosecutor with a grand jury and grand jury subpoena power and the federal courts to back up the compliance with those subpoenas. They did not have FBI agents. They didn't have a team of prosecutors. The House had to do this as legislators. They're not trained criminal investigators, or at least some of them were, but they didn't have that power of the executive branch of the Justice Department behind them. So by definition, they did not have the tools, the financial resources, and the enforcement capabilities that a prosecutor would. So they had one hand or two hands tied behind their backs to begin with, because Bill Barr didn't appoint a special prosecutor, unlike former Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein did when he appointed Mueller. Barr didn't even turn over the whistleblower complaint, as we know, I think in violation of a statute, frankly. But so that wasn't going to happen. That being said, once we got to the Senate, John Bolton's book leaked out a little bit, and it was clear that to the extent to which the factual narrative had a gap in the House, it was what was the president's actual thinking. You can piece together circumstantial evidence that he withheld the aid to help his election, but we don't have the smoking gun. And, of course, as lawyers, we know you don't need the smoking gun. Lots of people are in jail based on circumstantial evidence of intent. But John Bolton made public he was there and he could testify as to his actual intent. So my position was, by the time we got to the Senate, even though arguably the House should have done more, the stakes are high enough that the American people were entitled to know all the facts, and here's someone with firsthand knowledge of the president's intent, and both sides of the aisle of the American populace, and something as important as impeachment, should have been able to hear from that person. In addition, I think there's a strong argument that is that from a textualist standpoint, the word trial means something in the Constitution. We know in the Sixth Amendment and the Seventh Amendment, Sixth Amendment, right to jury trial for criminals or and criminal trials, Seventh Amendment, civil trials. The framers understood a trial meant evidence. They talked about witnesses in the Sixth Amendment. So the idea that there'd be a, quote, trial without witnesses is anathema, I think, to common sense, and Americans understood that. But, of course, again, I think the Republicans gamed the system, and the Democrats didn't push back. I think the Democrats could have probably done more. And I wrote on this in real time as well, so this is not Monday morning quarterbacking. They could have done more in the Senate proceedings, too, to push for a fairer, more transparent process.
They didn't move to compel. They didn't ask for any rulings from Chief Justice Roberts.
Correct.
They didn't seek intervention from the chair, essentially. They stuck to the rules. And you think that they could have been more proactive?
Moving to compel would have been the House. In the Senate, they could have done a couple things. First of all, I think at a minimum, I know there was some concern about getting the Chief Justice involved, but the rules give him a lot of authority, the rules that have been in place since Andrew Johnson. Chief Justice Chase during the Johnson trial was quite active. At a minimum, they could have asked for strike false information and false legal statements from the record. Please, Your Honor, that is not factually supported. The House, for example, this is something Pat Cipollone said, the members of the House and the Republican Party were able to be in every single deposition. Please strike that from the record. I don't understand why that didn't happen, number one. Number two is there was nothing precluding those lawyers from filing a brief. File a brief with Chief Justice Roberts saying, please read the rules to allow more evidence than we're getting. Here's the historical argument for what a trial means. Here are the separation of powers implications for what a trial means. And then the justice would have said, listen, I'm going to put this to a Senate vote, but on the record, we would have the Supreme Court justice, the chief of the entire federal court system, weighing in on legal principles, which he is clearly capable of doing. They do it all the time. And the Constitution handpicked that person to preside over this trial for a reason, because the vice president was too political. That assumes, in my mind, that person had more discretion than a potted plant banging a gavel.
Yeah, the appearance of the Chief Justice, I think, is a topic for another conversation as to what that does to the institution of the Supreme Court through him, represented through him, essentially reading out questions and asking the majority leader, you know, what to do next.
Twice, I was going to say, in his defense, he did refuse to read questions that would have outed the whistleblower, and he deserves tremendous credit for that.
So, and another argument against witnesses relates to his intervention, which is that if there had been witnesses and the courts had to get involved, then there would have been perhaps, you know, dual involvement by the Chief Justice in a process in the Senate and overseeing what's happening in the courts, eventually ruling on witnesses.
Unless he could have just ruled on all of it. I think there's an argument he didn't need to send it to a lower court under Article III jurisdiction, because under his jurisdiction as the presiding officer of the impeachment trial, he had original jurisdiction to make those calls. He didn't need to siphon it through Article III. I think that's the argument that I would have made.
So the vote on witnesses broke along party lines, with the exception of Senator Romney, who voted for witnesses. Otherwise, it was party line vote, no witnesses.
I think there might have been two Republicans.
Oh, Senator Snow also.
Sorry, but that was
Senator Collins.
Collins. That was the nail biting edge of the seat vote, more so than the acquittal. And that was unfortunate, because it left Americans so divided that they don't have belief in the legitimacy of the process. And like I say, in regular life, if your kid loses the Little League game, but the rules were fair and they were properly enforced, you know, take them out for pizza, you don't get baseball bats out and get angry. But if you feel like it was completely rigged or unfair, then you not only get upset about the outcome, but you lose faith and respect in the whole process, and you pull your kid out. And pulling people out psychologically, emotionally, from the important, I think, privilege we have of democracy is absolutely devastating. And it's too bad. I mean, that's an understatement, that more members of Congress didn't look at it from a macro standpoint, from a meta standpoint. But most people don't look at it from a meta standpoint, which is why I do what I do.
Tell me what you think of, I think, Senator Romney's statements in connection with the deliberation, and I guess there really wasn't deliberation. There was just then, after the witnesses were voted down, the Senate moved to sort of hear statements from senators and their votes on the impeachment counts. And Senator Romney broke with his party and got a lot of press on that. And I think, arguably, Senator Jones from Alabama, who comes from a 60% Trump-approving state, also kind of voted against his political interests as well. But Senator Romney got a lot of publicity for his statement and his vote. Did that strike you in any particular way, or resonate?
I thought it was... You know, it was a bright spot and a dark canvas for where we are in American democracy, and that What people lose sight of is that there's laws and then there's norms, and norms are sort of a close cousin of values. And we all have to make decisions based on our own value system, and that includes integrity. And that seems to be lost and not part of the dialogue. I mean, the Federalist Papers talked about it. People in office, we assume, just like people who teach our children, people who run our churches, people who manage hospitals, make decisions based on, you know, hard calls based on ethics, not just on their own personal consequences or professional consequences for themselves. And I think Mitt Romney demonstrated real courage in that moment. And I think democracy does take heroes and courage to be sustained. And I want to say, I mean, keep in mind, Mitt Romney and his family probably have to have a security detail for a very long time by virtue of that vote. So this is not, it goes beyond politics in my mind. And I think that he deserves, at least he gets my personal respect in that regard, because I think living your life based on your own value system is what keeps you on track, and he did that.
Yeah, I commend to students to read the statement because it was very unusual in terms of sort of what you expect to hear.
Well, he has a deep faith as a Mormon, and the people derive that sense of value system from various places, but for him, that's real. And I have, as I said, I have a lot of respect for that.
That was clearly evident. He choked up when he talked about his faith. That was very, very evident. So you called it a dark canvas. Was this process legitimate? Does it comport with the Constitution, or are you concerned about the whole process as it has come out? Do you feel like it's somehow distorted the meaning of the Constitution?
I think the outcome is we're seeing it now in the aftermath. The argument that Adam Schiff made is that an unaccountable presidency strikes at the heartbeat of democracy. And we're seeing that. We're seeing within 48 hours, the president fired Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, who had testified against him, who was decorated, you know, war hero, career diplomat, officer, and his brother, who had no involvement in this, fired Gordon Sondland. Of course, he has the discretion to do that, but there was no ambiguity that it was retaliatory. And we've also seen, you know, interventions in the Mike Flynn investigation, in the Roger Stone sentencing, both sentencings. And remember, Roger Stone and Mike Flynn, those prosecutions came out of the Mueller probe that was supposed to be independent, and now it's becoming politicized. So what we're seeing is a president who understands there are no checks on his behavior, and the framers understood that power will be abused and entrenched and abused if there aren't any limitations. We know that in our regular lives. So I think from, again, a meta level, yes, it was a colossal failure, and I have deep concerns about the validity of democracy going forward as a result, because, you know, there's not any legislative check. Impeachment isn't working to address abuses of power. The president violated legislation. The president violated the appropriations clause. The president violated or bypassed the Senate confirmation process in having Rudy Giuliani do his work for him. The president completely blew up oversight authority by Congress by stonewalling and not turning over a single document. So if you look at the levers by which the Congress institutionally is positioned to oversee the office of the president, not just this president, all of those have pretty much gone. And so now we see the belt and suspenders of the White House grow. And what the framers were concerned about is the result of that will be picking and choosing who gets justice, who gets retribution based on political views or other sort of or aspects of ourselves that we're born with, race, you know, gender, ethnic origin, et cetera. And we're already seeing that. Obviously, Roger Stone got a better deal, and it's in response to a tweet, right? That's unusual. And my concern is we're going to see it go the other way, too. Not just Alexander Vindman, who the president's also called on the military to retaliate against him, because he testified truthfully under oath in Congress in connection with an impeachment hearing, but that we'll see winners and losers based on political views. And that's central to what our separation of powers has protected against.
Help us understand this point, because I think it's important. Most of what you've said the president has done, and he's done it, he has authority to do. He has authority to dismiss a White House official. He has authority to recall an ambassador. He technically has authority. He at least has the ability to weigh in on prosecutions. He may not have statutory authority, but and the Justice Department itself has the authority to alter sentencing recommendations. So we see a lot of things that you could say there's authority to do it. How is it a breach of trust or a violation of the rule of law or values that support the rule of law for this to go on?
Because it's the, I mean, it does come down to the rationale, the reasons for these things. I mean, if you look at the DOJ sentencing manual, the guidelines, it says that these decisions aren't to be made by having anything to do with political affiliation. And of course, Roger Stone was in jail, or was convicted on 5 criminal counts in relation to his relationship with WikiLeaks, which hacked the DNC servers and released damaging information about Hillary Clinton that helped to get the president elected. So there's clearly a conflict of interest in the president having a say in the sentencing. And traditionally, again, back to norms and integrity, presidents have just basically treated the Justice Department as independent so Americans can have faith that the facts and the law are driving criminal decisions, not politics and favoritism. So intent does matter. Again, gets back to this concept of a fiduciary. A fiduciary might technically have the power to invest in X versus Y, even if they're running somebody's trust fund, for example. But if the X happens to be a great investment, but it's Cousin Vinny's sort of fund or whatever, that could be a breach of the fiduciary duty because that person is not making that decision based on what's best for the beneficiary in a neutral fashion. It's self-interested. We have all kinds of laws that govern government employees and people who invest in the stock market and CEOs of companies, all kinds of laws that care a lot about the rationale for actions. The rationale for actions is the difference between something that's legal and something that's illegal. And there's the argument that that metric doesn't apply to the presidency is an argument for a monarchy or, in the hands of the wrong person, a dictatorship. The framers understood that. To me, it just doesn't pass, the straight face test to suggest that the president has unlimited power to do whatever he wants.
Did the president's defense essentially put this question to the voters by saying, well, it's an election year, Congress shouldn't be involved, and therefore all of this is an election issue? Is this what, voters should be deciding? This matters or it doesn't?
Well, two things. One is the word impeachment is in the Constitution, I think, like 6 times. So if impeachment itself was a violation of the electoral process, it would be unconstitutional, and it's not because it's in there. And it's in there in part for the reason that the framers were worried about using the power of office to get reelected. So elections itself can't fix that.
Senator Romney makes this point in his statement, I think, very, very well.
So, I mean, this is a perfect storm. When I said earlier, and I haven't said this, but now it's over, I do think this was impeachable conduct. And if there's nothing that's impeachable, if this isn't impeachable, I don't know what. I try not to sort of kind of stake my ground one way or the other politically because I'm really caring about the rule of law and thoughtful analysis that is sustainable across presidencies and not in any one particular party. That being said, I do think the only check on the office of the presidency going forward is November 2020. And because we now don't have a process for ensuring that there's electoral integrity, I don't know if that's a legitimate check on the presidency either. I mean, there have been multiple bills that have come through the House in a bipartisan fashion that have been stalled by Mitch McConnell to address the electoral interference in 2016. So the Senate Majority Leader's exercising power that I would say, arguably I've written on this, isn't in the Constitution. He doesn't have the authority. I mean, again, technically he does, right? It doesn't, there's not a mandamus provision, but you could make the argument that someone with integrity would say, okay, it has bipartisan support. I'm at least going to bring it to the floor. He won't do that, number one. Number two is that what Cambridge Analytica did in terms of slicing and dicing all these data bits of information and focusing, you know, into your phone, not misinformation or information that confuses voters, right? So you don't know what to believe. That is happening on a massive scale, and it's not just Russia. It could be China, it could be Saudi Arabia, and a recent piece in Politico said that it's happening in the Trump campaign. They have quite a bit of money, and there's a bunker out in Virginia who reportedly is using those same tactics. There's nothing stopping them to keep people from the polls, misinform people. A lot of people in this country don't know the facts because they get most of their information on Facebook. And what comes into their Facebook feed is tailored as distortions deliberately. And that's pretty well established. Mueller established that when it comes to Russian interference in 2016, for example.
Do you feel that what we've left now with impeachment is basically kind of de facto ordinary oversight? We don't really have impeachment the way that the framers intended it to be in the Constitution. We kind of have a, as you were referring to before, this sort of impossible situation to ever get a removal. So we're going to have sort of impeachment votes more frequently.
I don't know if we'll see impeachment votes more frequently, but I don't think it's a pink slip. I don't think it's a reasonable mechanism for removal. And I just want to say, I'm not sure how much time we have left, but I don't want people to feel super depressed. And that's what happens. This is so bleak. This is awful. The House of Representatives moved from one political party to another in 2018 with less than 50% of eligible voters voting. There are barriers to voting. My next book comes out in June 16th, called What You Need to Know About Voting and Why. I don't pretend to be a deep dive expert in campaign finance and election law and voting rights. However, I do think that there's power in numbers. And if that number were 60, 70, 80, 90, 98%, regardless of
big money,
it'd be
harder to have mischief.
It'd be much harder. It would be much harder to have our political spectrum hijacked by whatever the forces are, Democrats, Republicans, Russians, bots. And so the message has to be, get out there and cast your vote. If you want to do more, you can canvass in purple states from your phone. You can text voters from your phone. You can sign up for whatever campaign you care about on either side of the aisle. And we need poll workers. Most poll workers are aging. It's from a different generation of people that understood the importance of this. And technology is hard. They're not as fluid in it. So young people, if you care about this, this is really, it's not about protesting in the streets. It's about getting to the polls. And most states, as I put in my book, you can vote early. You can vote absentee. There are lots of ways of getting at it. So getting the message out to do it and do it early. There are people in this country who, since the beginning of the Republic, who don't want people to vote or want only the right people to vote. Why? Because it's so powerful. Why are there voter suppression efforts? Because the vote is so powerful. Why are there efforts to interfere in our elections? Because the vote is so powerful. So honor the privilege of being American and take back your own democracy and get those numbers way up high. In other countries like Australia, it's mandatory. There's law. We're not going to get there in our anti-socialist environment, which I'm not advocating for mandatory voting, but I am advocating for people to take control of their own government.
I like that as a way to end, and I wouldn't be a law school podcast without reminding listeners that Professor Wheely is going to be teaching as part of our Summer Institute on Campaign 2020 and the law. So please look that up on the website. If you Google WCL Summer Institute Campaign 2020, you'll find it for more information. Thank you very much for joining us for this conversation.
Thank you for having me, Professor.